Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for clicking, downloading, transferring it to your iPod or whatever else you do with it. And thanks to the people who support this program with their subscriptions, like Mark Brodsky, Wayne Bishop, Mark Lewis, and Eileen Weber. Get the lowdown at peterbcollins.com. Monthly subscriptions start at $5, annual $50, and I appreciate your support. Our intro music from the Oils of Australia. And did I hear you say? More and more voices are speaking up about the mess in Afghanistan, and Gareth Porter, who's been covering the story better than corporate media for sure, and as well as others who have been chronicling the events in Afghanistan and our misguided occupation over the past 10 years now. Gareth, welcome back to our program.
Hey, thanks very much for having me back again, Peter.
Well, it's good to talk with you, and I think there are many interesting developments since the last time we spoke. Let me talk with the first about the breaking news. Afghan police opened fire Monday, that was President's Day here in the United States, on Albanian and other international troops in southern Afghanistan, killing one Albanian and leading to the arrest of 11 Afghan policemen. And this is one of many so-called friendly fire incidents, but we're seeing more and more that Afghan troops are firing on the so-called NATO or coalition troops, and that many Americans have been targeted in these events. And Joel Brinkley, who was on our podcast recently, he is a former New York Times correspondent, now teaching journalism at Stanford, in his syndicated column about 2 weeks ago, recapped that the Afghan troops are in such bad shape. High levels of illiteracy, incredible levels of drug use, including on the job with heroin and hashish, and the loyalties of these soldiers that we are hoping to hand off control of this huge country to are clearly ill-prepared to do so. And we're going to talk in a moment about Lieutenant Colonel Danny Davis, who's courageously pulled back the curtain on the misleading and false reports of progress in Afghanistan. But first, what are your thoughts about the Afghan military and police, and whether or not we can even trust them while we're still there?
Well, I think you're absolutely correct in pinpointing this as being precisely at the epicenter of the problem of Afghanistan, the problematic, if you will, of this war that the United States has been waging for more than a decade, because I view the Afghan security forces, both the police and the Afghan National Army troops, as a kind of litmus of Afghan opinion and Afghan attitudes toward the U.S. and NATO troops occupying the country. And that litmus has been turning more and more dark and very hostile over the past several years. Ever since the number of U.S. and NATO troops has started to go sharply up, particularly since 2008, it is very clear that the impact of the foreign presence, military presence, on Afghan public opinion has been sharply not only negative, but has been extremely negative. And I think it's fair to say that the single biggest issue, the single biggest cause of this increased hatred and opposition to the U.S. and NATO forces, but particularly U.S. forces, has been the raids on homes mm-hmm. by special operations forces of the United States. This has engendered such enormous hatred of the foreign presence that I think this is really the primary issue. It's not the only issue mm-hmm. by any means, but I think it is the most cutting edge issue of all in terms of causing people to turn against the foreign presence in a very emotional, direct, and political way. And so what you're seeing here is a steep rise in the incidents that you've referred to. The U.S. military, and including Danny Davis, calls these blue-on-green, the blue-on-green incidents, meaning mm-hmm. that they are the attacks on U.S. NATO forces, the ISAF, so-called ISAF forces, by the Afghan military and police. And this is being caused by their very strong aversion to everything about the U.S. presence there that is causing them to feel that these are not their friends, these are not the people that they want to be allied with. These are the enemy.
And these night raids have been contentious for some time. I believe it was 2 years ago that Anand Gopal, who was then reporting for the Wall Street Journal, he's an independent, first really brought attention to both the night raids and the satellite detention centers, these prisons and holding units that are scattered across the landscape of Afghanistan. Yeah. And there's very little reporting. You know, the television networks don't even have dedicated correspondents in Kabul anymore. And so, and I haven't seen any recent embeds of you know, major network journalists with the military there.
Yeah, so I think that's pretty much come to an end. You're right.
So we only get official information, and I want to come to Davis here in a minute because he's really showing a sharp contrast about that. But the night raids and the detention of individuals who are often just disappeared, at least from the point of view of the civilian population, this is a major irritant against the occupying forces. And is it your inference, or do we have even better evidence than inference that these attacks on NATO and U.S. soldiers are either direct or indirect retaliation for the tactics that the U.S. is using?
We do have very direct evidence, and I've reported this in the story that was just published this week on the fact that the night raids have been the cause of hanging up or you know, holding up agreement between the United States and the Karzai administration on a longer term U.S. military presence beyond 2014, which, you know, the U.S. It's very clear the Obama administration thought this was going to be a slam dunk when they initiated these negotiations just over a year ago. But it's turned out that Karzai has absolutely refused to give in on this issue of night raids. And that has really been the thing more than anything else. It's night raids and the U.S. continuing to detain Afghan prisoners in their own detention center, not just the satellite detention centers, which mm-hmm. you've mentioned, which are scattered around the country for, they can hold them for a couple of weeks, but then they have to be sent off to this big major detention center near the Bagram Air Base.
Right.
And the Afghan government, under very strong popular political pressure has continued to demand that the United States end the night raids or turn them over to the Afghan government, with Afghan forces taking the lead, and stop the detention and holding of Afghan prisoners and turn that over to the Afghan government as well. And as I reported in my story this week, the U.S. military is saying no, they're not willing to go along with that. The view is that basically the night raids is all they've got. That's all they've got left. That's the main thing that they have to resist from their point of view, the Taliban onslaught, the insurgents' onslaught, and they're simply not willing to give it up.
And what is the rationale that these raids cannot be conducted during daylight? Is it too risky for American troops?
The argument is that you give up surprise when you do it in the daylight, and in fact that there's more likely to be armed resistance by the Taliban to a raid during daylight hours. Now, you know, whether that's really true or not, I cannot say, but that's the official rationale for it. But the point I want to make, Peter, is that the U.S. military, when it raids these homes, it is causing not just the ordinary Afghan civilians, but Afghan military and police personnel to believe that these infidels, and they do regard American troops as infidels in Afghanistan, have no business even going into an Afghan private home, let alone, you know, pushing down the door, blowing down the door, or using rifle butts to open up a door to a private home and going in and searching the place where Afghan women are located. Mm-hmm. And this is an extremely sensitive point culturally in Afghanistan that the U.S. military has known about all along, but they seem to have ultimately a blind spot, an unwillingness to acknowledge that they're not going to be able to get away with this. It's just simply not going to work.
And Gareth, on the point of detention and Karzai's demands in that regard, first, let me state that I do not consider Karzai to be a legitimate leader, and I don't think that he is any kind of a reliable partner for the United States. That said, I think that his demands regarding the prison near Bagram are legitimate, and I think that they have traction in terms of international law and standards of human rights. We know that, well, there's too much that we don't know about who's being held there, and that's part of the problem. The Obama administration clearly does not want to hand over control to the Afghans because there would be an audit of who is there and why, and, you know, what they are charged with or why they're being held. There also appears to be at least a portion of the prison population there that was not picked up in Afghanistan. So it's the new Guantanamo. It's a parking zone, a prison parking zone, for people who can no longer be brought into the United States if they are considered terrorists. And if they're some sort of combatant, Obama isn't interested politically in adding to the population at Guantanamo.
Well, so, in some ways, Peter, I think it's even worse than that. I think what has happened here is that the United States has picked up thousands and thousands of civilian non-combatants who they either have no real intelligence on suggesting that or indicating that they are insurgents, or they know they're not insurgents, and they are picking them up, keeping them for weeks, in some cases months, to interrogate them in the hope of getting information about the insurgents. And this, again, is really, you know, very, it's causing a great deal of anger in the communities where these raids are taking place, which includes just, you know, enormous numbers of communities, because they're carrying out literally thousands of raids every year. And so let me just complete the thought that I had started.
Sure.
In a very roundabout way, which is that the evidence that we have about the hatred of U.S. And NATO forces because of these night raids, in large part, not solely, but in large part, comes from a study that was done by a sociologist for the U.S. military started in late 2010 and finished in the spring of 2011. It involved 613 military and police personnel of the Afghan government who were brought together in focus groups in 19 locations in three different eastern provinces of Afghanistan. And what it revealed was that a very large proportion of these focus groups mentioned the night raids as a reason not just for their hard feelings toward the Americans, but as a result of, but saying as a result of these night raids, there were serious altercations between the Afghan security personnel and American personnel. So actually was causing, you know, fist fights or threatened fist fights between the two sides because they felt so strongly about it.
Well, and Gareth, there is also a report that was published recently. I believe it was from a UN agency, and it was based not on a poll, but on questions that were put in interrogations to captured Taliban and other fighters who are resisting the occupation and the Karzai government. And I'm careful to call it a report and not a poll because this is the result of interrogation, and we can only hope that the standards of interrogation have been elevated as Obama has articulated in his rhetoric. At any rate, these people responded that they fully support the insurgency. They are simply waiting out the American and foreign occupiers. And they all believe that within a few years, the Taliban will resume control of the entire nation of Afghanistan. And when you process that information, it really does show that our occupation is not seen as a serious long-term threat by the fighters on the ground in Afghanistan.
That's right. I think that's absolutely a correct reading of the study based on the interrogation of Taliban prisoners that you're referring to. And by the way, I mean, as a historian, I have to tell you that this is extremely reminiscent of the parallel studies that were done by the RAND Corporation during the Vietnam War based on their interrogation, their questioning, interviewing of Viet Cong prisoners. They had the same kind of message that they got from these interrogations or these interviews, which was that in the end, these people felt that the resistance to the foreign presence would triumph.
Yeah. And Gareth, I think that's the perfect moment here to bring in Lieutenant Colonel Danny Davis, because over the last 2 weeks, I've become aware of him. You first interviewed him 3 years ago, is that right?
That's right. I met him 3 years ago when he first had come back from a tour of duty in Iraq, but he knew that eventually he would be going to Afghanistan, and he'd already had a tour in Afghanistan in 2005, 2006, and had done a lot of traveling around the country, had a lot of insights, and he was quite sure at that point that the Obama administration's troop surge was going to not only fail, but was going to make the situation worse. And so he took it upon himself to write up a very long analysis and with recommendations for what he called going long rather than going deep, going long rather than going big, so that he was calling for a much smaller U.S. military presence on the ground that a larger military presence would cause greater resistance on the part of the Afghan insurgents.
Now,
and that
Gareth,
they would get more popular support for it.
Just to refresh your recall, I managed to, through a search, pull up the article that you
yes.
wrote in October of 2009, and the headline reads, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel L. Davis on going deep rather than long
right.
in Afghanistan.
Right. Okay, deep rather than long, exactly.
Yeah.
You're correct.
No, you got it right the first time.
Yeah.
Now, Tell us a little bit about this, because when I first read the recent report, which is scathing, and this is the declassified version that has been fed to news outlets. I first picked it up, of course, from the British media. But Davis is very careful in his language. He talked about how his expectations had been raised by the authoritative reports and media coverage here in the United States, that we're gaining on the Taliban, that we've virtually wiped out Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And these rosy reports that are being generated by the Pentagon and basically just being taken as dictated by the media in this country suggest that we're you know, things are improving and that we're gaining control in Kandahar province, and that, you know, we've taken out all these bad guys. And of course, a lot of this is spun for the president's reelection, like virtually everything that the White House is staging these days. But Davis really tells a very different story, and I see him as a pivotal character here in some manner, like Walter Cronkite was when his mind changed after going to Vietnam. I pegged that at about 1968.
That's a very interesting parallel. I had not thought of that until you raised it, but I think it does have a lot of traction, that he is, in fact, the person who is suggesting that this is not going to work at exactly the moment when it can make a difference in terms of public opinion. And I do believe, in fact, that the timing of his very public and very effective dissent is so perfect that, in fact, it is going to increase the influence of his critique far beyond what it would have been had he done it a year or two earlier. And I think you're right to compare him with Cronkite, who's you know, very telling response to the Tet Offensive was this is now a different situation. We can no longer win, and we have to reconsider.
And to briefly summarize what Davis has recently reported, following his 1 year study of the situation in Afghanistan, is devastating. He describes these checkpoints where Afghan troops or police are in charge, and a guy who they clearly suspect is a member of the Taliban or other insurgents get on a motorcycle, ride right through the checkpoint, and somebody calls to the checkpoint and says, "Stop that guy," but nobody does. And these stories are replayed with different details, but the you know, common thread is that these troops are a joke, that they're not prepared to confront civilians or guerrillas in their own midst, and that they are drug-riddled, and you know, that they're prone to desertion. I mean, then we're fed this line in the United States that they're making progress, and Leon Panetta says it's going so well that we can pull combat troops out next year.
Yes, this is I think the most persuasive, the most powerful part of his presentation is his portrayal of the reality of the Afghan army, which is supposed to take over this war from the United States and take it to final success. And I think what he's showing here is that this is an army of people who are not motivated to fight the Taliban. One of the points that he makes, although he doesn't emphasize it, but I have talked with him about this privately, and I can tell you that he has a lot more information that he has not really discussed, except for the most passing reference in his essay. But one of his key points is that there is widespread evidence of accommodation between the Afghan military personnel and police personnel on one hand and the Taliban on the other. They have been the conversations by telephone between the Afghan military and the Taliban have been intercepted on many occasions, and it's well known that that these accommodations have in fact been worked out in a large proportion of the places where Danny has visited. And Danny has visited virtually every place in Afghanistan where U.S. forces have been stationed.
Mm-hmm.
So he has a very wide angle lens view of the situation in Afghanistan. And I think what his what he has uncovered about the Afghan military is really devastating, as you correctly put it. And it's not simply that they're drug addicts in many cases, which is, of course, true, or that they're ineffective, which is also true, poorly trained, unable to take or unwilling to take training from U.S. trainers, but that, as we began the conversation saying, their political attitudes are extremely hostile to a great extent. Not everybody by any means, but a large percentage of these recruits are people who bring with them the same kinds of attitudes toward the foreign presence that you get in the general population. It's bound to be that way.
And Gareth, from my perspective, Lieutenant Colonel Davis is displaying balls of steel here because he does not limit, and again, there's a classified report that we, you and I can't see that most certainly goes into more detail and is probably even more devastating. But in the unclassified version, and I saw him interviewed on the Public Television News Hour recently, he goes further than just revealing the mess in Afghanistan. He says that, you know, we, the Americans, are the victims of, quote, a pattern of overt and substantive deception by, quote, many of America's most senior military leaders in Afghanistan. Now, that is a very significant indictment.
It is a significant indictment, and I can tell you that Danny has come to this position not lightly at all. I mean, it is partly due to the fact that even before he went to Afghanistan, he, in his career, in his 17-year Army career, he had been involved previously in episodes involving procurement and other issues having to do with the logistics and weaponry of the U.S. Army, in which he saw clear-cut cases where the high-level generals involved in these issues did not tell the truth. And so he has a series, in his experience, he's had a series of experiences where he has seen the same thing happen over and over again, and he has discovered to his sad, to his sadness, that the U.S. military has been commanded and has been led by people, not universally, not all of them, but a large proportion of the high-level leadership of the U.S. military and the U.S. Army have been people who are putting their own careers ahead of the interests of the United States. And so what he found in Afghanistan was yet another case where all the way from General David Petraeus through the high-level staff officers working under him to people in Washington who are leaders of the U.S. Army and the U.S. military, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, there has been a tendency to tell the American news media and public and Congress what will support the interests of the military in keeping public support for the war in Afghanistan rather than telling them the truth. And that is really, you're right, that is a very courageous thing to do. This is obviously not sitting well with a lot of the brass in the military. But Danny is somebody, as you've correctly stated, who is playing it by the books. He is not revealing any classified information. He's been very careful about that.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but he has followed regulations to in a very punctilious manner in doing anything that was not the absolutely clear-cut right of every serviceman, including talking to and providing classified information to those in Congress who are who have the right to receive it.
And here is a comparison that Lieutenant Colonel Davis offers. We're going to first read a quote from David Petraeus, who ran CENTCOM, is the brilliant guy on counterinsurgency. was directly managing the occupation of Afghanistan, and now in that shuffle that made sure that no new thinking will penetrate the Obama inner circle or the National Security Council or those who are conducting this war, they moved him over to the CIA. So, quote, from Petraeus, and this is only a year old, March 15th last year, quote, the momentum achieved by the Taliban in Afghanistan since 2005 has been arrested in much of the country and reversed in a number of important areas. Now, that is a carefully calibrated, crafted PR statement. And Lieutenant Colonel Davis wrote, instead, I witnessed the absence of success on virtually every level. Insurgents controlled virtually every piece of land beyond the eyeshot of a U.S. or International Security Assistance Force base. Now, that just shows that we're being too polite because Petraeus is lying.
Petraeus is lying, and he, I think, has stated that pretty clearly. Although, you know, he also has a pretty nuanced understanding of how these people operate and why they think the way they do. I mean, he has told me about incidents which he's familiar with personally, in which, you know, high-ranking people like Petraeus in Kabul have systematically made it clear to intelligence officials who brief them every day that they don't want to hear bad news. It's been conveyed to them in unmistakable terms, that is the intelligence briefers, that people like Petraeus and other high-ranking officers do not want to have the briefings include things that conflict with the success narrative. And so that has been a systematic dynamic that has been operating for a long time in the U.S. command in Afghanistan. He's seen it personally, up close and personal, and he can attest to the way in which that has skewed the entire system of reporting in Afghanistan, even though he says that if you are aware of what is actually conveyed in the classified documents, the classified intelligence reporting and political reporting from the field, you find that they are still telling the truth. It's simply not getting to the political leadership in Washington. It's not getting to Congress. It's not getting to the news media.
And Gareth, I'd like to draw again on your work as a historian and your book, Perils of Dominance, about the war in Vietnam. Because when I heard Leon Panetta's quote, as he was going to Brussels to meet with the NATO brass, and he had been on 60 Minutes just three nights before and did not unload this comment at that time. But on his way to Brussels, he tells reporters that he is hopeful that we can pull out combat troops sometime next year in 2013. Now, there's a lot of wiggle room in what he said. But it reminded me of Kissinger 72, peace is at hand. And that this is a, you know, we continue to kill people and suffer American losses in Vietnam for 3.5 years after Kissinger made that comment. And that was the first thing I thought of when I heard this statement attributed to Leon Panetta.
Well, I think the parallel, again, is apt, primarily because what we're talking about here is two comments that were made in an election year, a presidential election year. And Henry Kissinger, of course, was talking at a moment when it was vital for President Nixon in his reelection bid to convey to the American public that peace was at hand and that they didn't have to worry about the war going on for more years. And, of course, this is precisely the dynamic that is at work with the Obama White House today. And there is no doubt in my mind that that is why Leon Panetta was suggesting for the first time that the White House was hopeful that we could actually have U.S. troops out by the end of 2013. I expect we're going to hear more along those lines and that we're going to see some evidence that the White House is putting pressure on the U.S. military to get those troops coming home so that he can make that case during a presidential election campaign.
And Gareth, as a political observer and a lifetime news and political junkie, while I deplore the cynicism that I think is reflected in this insincere comment from a man who I know and used to have great respect for, Mr. Panetta, it's remarkable to me, given that this is now lock, stock, and barrel Barack Obama's war. He's escalated troop levels twice. He can't blame Bush for this. Bin Laden is gone, and it's not about Al-Qaeda. It's not about 9/11. So Obama has a very thin foundation for any rational support for the military ongoing military presence in Afghanistan. But, and I rarely use sports metaphors, but I see this like in basketball, a pick, where Obama, by authorizing Panetta to make this statement, then produced a reaction from the guy who hopes to be the Republican nominee, Mitt Romney. And Romney called the president naive for wanting to pull troops out of Afghanistan. Now, this war is hugely unpopular. 66% of the public wants us out of there very soon, if not yesterday. And that includes a lot of Republicans.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Mitt Romney is cornered into defending Obama's war. And Obama is now the guy who wants to bring the troops home, and Romney's the guy who wants to keep them there.
Well, I think you're right, Peter. I think it was a very clever ploy, and Obama presumably has taken the measure of Mitt Romney and knows that he's kind of, you know, not the brightest bulb on the string and is likely to play into his strategy. So, you know, I think you're right. It was a very interesting maneuver by the White House to set up a situation where the president will be winning on that issue during the election campaign.
Now, I'd like to ask for your thoughts, because we're speaking here in the third week of February. The election is in November, and the Obama team has to be praying to a Christian God, of course, not an Islamic one, that things can be maintained, that they can continue to control and spin the message coming from Afghanistan. And I think Karzai is once again the wild card, because his demand for sovereignty over the prison at Bagram, his demand for sovereignty as a basis for an end to the night raids, I believe that these are very potent issues that could cause the Obama team to lose control of the spin on Afghanistan. Now, they're in a pretty safe place, because we know the Republicans will not attack on that issue. But I have concerns, particularly, and we'll touch on Iran in a moment, but I feel that we are really arrogant in our approach to these military operations and believe that we have a much greater level of control than, in fact, we do.
I couldn't agree with you more, Peter.
Go ahead and tell me what you think, in addition to what I've mentioned, the flashpoints are that could cause Obama to lose control of the Afghan spin between now and the election.
Well, I think it's much less Karzai than it is the Afghan insurgents themselves. The Afghan insurgency itself is clearly growing in effectiveness over time, rather than declining, as Petraeus wanted us to believe. And you know, there is very serious danger from the White House point of view, from their political perspective, that there are going to be a series of incidents, or more than incidents, perhaps even a prolonged campaign by the insurgents during the latter half of this year, that begins to take advantage of the fact that U.S. troops are in fact being pulled out. And inevitably leaving gaps compared with the situation that existed last year and the year before. There's no doubt in my mind that the Taliban are perfectly capable of exploiting those. They know exactly where the gaps will be. They will take advantage of that in the most spectacular way possible to demonstrate that they are indeed in control of the situation in the war. And I think that that is what could, in fact, upset, the narrative that the president hopes to portray, which is that he is indeed getting out, but not at the expense of losing Afghanistan. Now, you know, I think that he's going to have a hard time sustaining that narrative, but that will be, you know, he will at least still be able to say we're on the way out, which is more important. At least I think that's what he's going to try to do. And by the way, I do think that Karzai is likely to give in on this rather than to hold out, because his bargaining position vis-a-vis the United States has actually weakened by the fact that that the United States, you know, the White House is talking about withdrawing faster than it had intended to do.
And he is
conveying a sort of lack of urgency about wanting to keep U.S. troops there.
Well, and as you and I have discussed previously, Gareth, the signals are incredibly mixed. Karzai has said that he'd like to keep U.S. troops there for 10 years.
Yeah.
He'd like to see money flowing into his country for 15 years from this day forward. And we get these messages from the Obama administration that, oh, yeah, we're getting out of there. We're getting out of there. 2014, we'll be gone. And I flatly don't believe it.
Well, I don't think that they're intending to be gone completely, no. I mean, obviously, they intend to leave the special forces, special operations forces units there, but that plus some air power is all that there's going to be. I mean, there's no doubt that the conventional forces are going to be pulled out by 2014 or by sometime before the end of 2014. But, you know, I think that is, in fact, going to accelerate now. But, I mean, they're in a dilemma because it's precisely the special operations forces who are so immensely unpopular in Afghanistan. And that, as the sole form of offensive operations for the United States in Afghanistan, spells, you know, a very serious problem for both Karzai and the United States, because it means that that they really do not have the capability to stand up against the effectiveness of the insurgents, which is effective because they have the ability to communicate to rural populations a message that is credible, whereas the Karzai administration in the United States do not have that.
Mm-hmm. Gareth, though, were you ever a Monty Python fan?
No, I was never into Monty Python.
I
appreciate some British humor, but mm-hmm. Monty Python, I did not get to see those.
All right. Well, they had a routine called the Argument Clinic, where a guy would knock on a door and go in and have an argument with somebody, but he'd always go in the wrong door, and there was an apology door, and there was an excuse door, and he was looking for an argument.
Yeah.
And I bring it up because I'm looking at a website now that has a litany of American apologies for killing the 8 children in an air raid, about 3 weeks ago. Today, the apology is for burning a Koran at the Bagram Air Base. And we've been making a lot of mistakes that do cause that ugly term collateral damage. But it seems that we've got to apologize more and more often, either for soldiers caught pissing on a dead soldier and videotaping themselves in the process, or these incidents where innocent people are being killed.
Yeah, and it's really too late to try to repair this damage. It's way too late. The data is already very clear that over a period of years since 2008, the United States military has created an image with regard to the population of Afghanistan, which is extremely unfriendly. The image of the U.S. military presence is one that they really have the strongest distaste, the Afghan population in the rural areas in particular, which have been subject to the U.S. military presence over the last few years. They regard the Americans not as infidels, as I've said, but as crude, ugly, insulting to the military and police personnel they come in contact with, just across the board. I mean, the United States has made a hash of it. It's just a complete failure from beginning to end.
Gareth, is there anything else that you'd like to comment on related to Afghanistan? Because I want to briefly ask your comments on the escalating tensions with Iran.
No, I think we really need to go to Iran because that is where the danger is. That's where the real threat to American security and the security and stability of the region is.
Well, why don't you start with your assessment, because the way it's being reported in the American media is that Dempsey, the head of the Joint Chiefs, went to Israel, said don't attack. The Obama administration publicly is counseling Israel not to attack Iran preemptively, to take out nuclear sites. And it's hard to know whether that is a firm and deep position of the Obama administration or if it's simply posturing.
Well, I think it is a firm and deep position of the Obama White House. I think that Obama himself really does want to deter the Israelis from attacking. However, when I use the word deep, I should have qualified that, because I think that it is serious, but at the same time, it does not go deep enough, because there is not yet any indication that President Obama is prepared to stand up publicly and say that we will not abide an Israeli attack on Iran. This cannot happen. This should not happen. This will not happen, because this would affect the relationship between the United States and Israel, as it obviously would. How can the United States be a passive party, or for that matter, an active party in an Israeli attack on Iran, which would result in retaliation against U.S. forces in the region? And unless the United States takes very decided and direct action to avoid this, would drag the United States into an Israeli war against Iran. It would have the worst possible consequences for U.S. interests around the world, and we would be essentially subjecting the United States to a situation which the White House knows would be a terrible disaster for the United States, and what he must do is to say this publicly and to say that it would not be acceptable, and the United States would have to seriously reconsider its relationship to Israel. There's no evidence that he's willing to do that yet, and in the absence of that willingness, it's not clear that the policy of trying to distance the administration from Netanyahu's threat to attack Iran is going to be effective, because of Netanyahu's obvious ability to manipulate U.S. politics and to take advantage of pressure on the White House from the Republican right and from news media, which appears to mirror to a great extent the views of the Republican right in its coverage of the whole issue.
Well, and we had the president's State of the Union message, where he once again declared that we are in lockstep with Israel. And I find that fundamentally offensive, that we would, link or weld our foreign policy to that of a smaller nation that has very specific self-interest in its region, and to tie our future and our current policies, particularly when that region is roiled right now with hot wars that we're involved with in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. We've still got troops in Central Africa chasing down some warlord, and I'm not clear on what that mission is. But at a time of great instability, the civil war in Syria rages on. The crackdown in Bahrain continues with our and Saudi support. To imagine that region can absorb the shock of a preemptive strike on Iran and not have heavy, heavy blowback on the United States is just incredibly irrational.
Well, it's perfectly clear that this is understood by the U.S. military leadership. That is precisely what animates General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That is what animated his predecessor, Admiral Mullen, to be very strongly opposed to any Israeli attack on Iran. And the White House understands this perfectly well. So there's no problem in terms of the understanding of just how serious that whole situation would be.
Yeah, but the countdown to the AIPAC conference is in the single digits now.
Well, exactly. The problem is precisely that AIPAC and the Israeli lobby and the forces that they represent have a hammerlock on the key institutions of U.S. political life, the Congress, the Republican Party, and to a significant degree, I mean, through an indirect, phenomenon which we don't entirely understand, but clearly does exist. The U.S. news media also reflects the views of much more of the Israeli lobby than they do of the administration on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right. I mean, it's offensive, and something needs to be done about it. I mean, it is a severe, profound political crisis in the United States, one of several interlocking crises, that the United States has lost its freedom of action, in effect, to pursue its own independent policy with regard to Iran.
And, Gareth, we have these very conflicting reports about the state of nuclear enrichment and the capacity of Iran to actually develop a weapon. But fundamental to that is the false choice that is offered as a rubric in this dialogue, if there's any debate these days, and that is the phony statement that Iran cannot be permitted to possess a nuclear weapon. Now, I and no one else wants to see Iran become a nuclear power, but to turn a blind eye to the fact that we support Israel and it's a nuclear power, and we know Pakistan has nukes, and we don't try to bomb their nuclear facilities. We know India does, and right on down the line. Yet the hysteria that is created, that this is an existential threat to Israel, and it's building to the point that Israel has no choice but to take action. I mean, all of those are false contentions.
They are false, and I mean, it's really quite simple that the fundamental facts are not really in contest. They are not controversial. The fundamental fact that both the U.S. Intelligence community and the Israeli intelligence community agree that Iran has not decided to go for a nuclear weapon. And it's also, by the way, agreed between the U.S. government and the Israeli government that the Iranians are not going to kick out the IAEA anytime soon, which would be the sign, the signal, that Iran has, in fact, made a decision to go for a nuclear weapon. A fascinating speech that Ehud Barak, the Israeli defense minister, made last November, or rather an interview with CNN, which was not widely quoted. He said that the Iranians are not kicking out the IAEA, and the reason they don't do that is because they know that that would be a signal that they are going for a nuclear weapon. And as long as they don't kick out the IAEA, he didn't say this, but it's very clear that we know that Iran is not going for a nuclear weapon.
Well, and we have this inconvenient problem that Iran is signed to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which permits them to develop nuclear energy to generate electricity. And we first tried to sell American nuclear equipment back when the Shah was still running Iran. So the false choices and the duplicity that's displayed seems to have almost no limit.
The duplicity has been going on ever since the beginning of the Iranian nuclear program. For two decades and more, for more like three decades, the U.S. government has been over and over again saying, oh, we're afraid that Iran is... We believe that Iran is going for nuclear weapons, and they're only 5 or 10 years away. It started out 10 years away, and then
right.
They went to 5 years away. But in fact, the policy of the U.S. government under every administration since the Islamic Republic of Iran was created in 1979 has been that Iran must not be allowed, will not be allowed, to have any nuclear power program. They cannot have any nuclear program at all, which, as you say correctly, is their right under the NPT. So the real story here is that the United States has unjustly and illegally prevented Iran from having a legitimate nuclear program from the very beginning.
And Gareth, finally, I'm very concerned that the covert skirmishes that are underway, we know that Iranian nuclear scientists have been gunned down on the streets of Tehran. The favorite tactic is a motorcycle that approaches a car with a magnetic bomb that's attached to the car and then detonated. And now we see Iranian reprisals using the exact same techniques to send a message to either Mossad or CIA or both, whoever is actually responsible for the attacks inside Iran. And in India and another country, just in the last 10 days, we've had two of the Georgia was the other one, right?
Yes, but Peter, finally, you've said something that I can disagree with for
all
the
right.
first time.
Please, go ahead.
In fact, I am extremely skeptical that any of those three countries, Georgia, India, or Thailand,
mm-hmm.
Were instances in which Iran was involved in any kind of activity, such as trying to set off a bomb against an Israeli diplomat.
Well, interesting. I'm happy to have you disagree with me. And are
I
you suggesting a false flag?
That both the Georgia case and the India case were completely phony. I think that that the one in Georgia, obviously, you know, it didn't go off, and it was discovered very conveniently before anyone got in the car. That can be easily dismissed. The one in India, I'm convinced, is a false flag attack.
Wow.
Simply because of the series of characteristics of the bomb itself and the way it was placed, which indicate that it was very clear that this was never intended to harm anyone in that car.
Hmm.
And, you know, it didn't blow up the car at all. All it did was set fire to the car.
Yeah.
And there was a 30 to 40 second delay, which gives plenty of time for anybody in the car to get out.
Mm-hmm.
The wife of the diplomat who worked for the embassy herself, testified apparently that the car was bumped from behind, giving her the signal that, you know, something was going on. She had plenty of time to get out, and she did get out, in fact, and was not burned. There was no sign of any burning. She had plenty of time, but apparently was hit by some shrapnel, which was thrown out of the car some distance. Or some metal, at least from the car, was embedded in her skin.
Well, thank you for raising that, because I'm generally skeptical, but in these cases, I took those reports at face value. And
well, I've been following it very closely, reading the Indian and Thai news reporting on this, and I can tell you that there's very, very strong circumstantial evidence to support this. In fact, I'm going to be writing about it in the coming days.
All right. Well, Gareth, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for your contributions to our knowledge on these issues, and we will be in touch.
Thanks so much, Peter.
I always come away learning something from these podcasts. I hope you do, too. Drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.